Hey, everyone, it's Greg Gutfeld. This is the one. If any of you know my background, I started in kind of popular health journalism after I left the American Spectator. But in 1990, I started at Prevention Magazine, and then I went to Men's Health, and I ran Men's Health. I was at Rodale for like 10 years. One thing you got to know about popular health journalism is that you kind of got to scare people to sell copies, and you got to make promises that often aren't real. But I started to get very, very skeptical about things that I was reading, and I had been reading Reason magazine for a while. And this one guy, Jacob Sullum, was a writer for is still a writer for Reason, but he was always writing about the other side of health, the other side of drugs that I wasn't finding anywhere else. And I just assumed that he was really old because he was so knowledgeable. And like I thought that he had to be like in his 60s, 50s or 60s back in 1990. But it turns out he's actually younger than me, which is really weird. So when I was reading him, I was assuming that he was 60, but he was actually 24. And when you think that way, that means somebody knows what they're doing if you assume that there's some old dude. Jacob, how are you?
All right. I'm glad to hear that I'm successful at impersonating an old person.
That's because you have so much wisdom. I wanted to talk to you originally about opioids because you've written about it. I've quoted you on it in my last article from, I think it was 2 weeks ago or last week. But I wanted today, a study was published. I'm talking about it on The Five. You've also written about this. The use of ecstasy or illegal MDMA in treating PTSD. And I noticed in the study in The Lancet, which came out today, that they used the phrase essentially cured, which you don't hear very often in a medical journal. What do you make of this?
Right. Well, it's not really surprising that MDMA is useful in psychotherapy. That is, in fact, what it was first known for back before it was banned.
Right.
It was banned in 1985 by the DEA, mm-hmm. which has the power to do that, by the way. They can take any substance they don't like and decide to ban it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the reason they banned it is people were starting to enjoy it,
yes.
which, of course, you can't have. people started using MDMA at dance clubs and in a party kind of situation, mm-hmm. which is quite familiar by now.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore became intolerable, and the DEA had to ban it. But the main people who were objecting when the DEA banned MDMA were people who were psychotherapists or psychologists in the mental health community, as they call it nowadays, who really had found this useful in their work. And mm-hmm. what they found is that this substance would make people intoxicated in the sense that they didn't know what they were saying or doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would leave them lucid, but at the same time, it would eliminate fear that they might have in talking about things that were troubling them or traumas they had gone through.
Mm-hmm.
It would make them more empathetic to other people, so it was found to be very useful in couples therapy. And it would make them more inclined to trust the therapist, which, of course, is important if you're going to have successful psychotherapy. So this was, this is all anecdotal, obviously. There weren't
right.
rigorous studies at the time. But it was. This is what MDMA was first known for. Then mm-hmm. it was banned. So now you've got over three. It's been over three decades since then, like 36 years, something like that. It's over 30 years at this
mm-hmm.
point. We are rediscovering now these uses for MDMA that were blocked for a long time. So in particular with post-traumatic stress disorder. Here you have a situation where somebody went through a horrible experience. It's left this sort of seemingly indelible mark on them. They have nightmares. They can't deal with other people. They feel isolated. They are intermittently angry. They have this startle reaction to things that's all out of proportion to the stimulus, and this can trouble them for years. And they have found that therapy can work if you confront the trauma you went through and what is it? What are the beliefs that are lingering about that trauma that are continuing to disrupt your life. But people tend not to stay with that kind of therapy because
mm-hmm.
it's very disturbing to have to confront these traumas.
Right.
So the idea was to combine MDMA with that sort of therapy, and then people would be more inclined to stick with it, more willing to be candid, and really reach the kinds of epiphanies that would be necessary to get past this. And really, it sounds like magic almost because mm-hmm. some of the people, like the guy I interviewed who I quoted in my column today, who's an Iraq war veteran, he said that not that like his whole life was perfect all of a sudden, but immediately he had a very substantial improvement. He had, for years, he couldn't sleep at night, and when he did get to sleep, he would have these horrible nightmares.
Right.
That was resolved after the first session, he said. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the rest of the stuff took a while to work through. It took maybe a couple of years, but you can see how you get results like these, where all of the people who were in the study had what they call chronic PTSD. It was resistant to treatments they had tried before, and the average, they have a score which indicates the severity of the symptoms, and their average was, I think, 87 going in. So mm-hmm. they're all definitely diagnosable. And then after the first couple of MDMA sessions, all the people who got the significant therapeutic doses of MDMA had substantial reductions. And in fact, most of them, just after the two sessions, no longer qualified for the PTSD diagnosis.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing.
So let me ask you, so this was banned in 85, and I keep thinking about when you ban something, you don't study it. So did this effectively – they weren't doing studies like these until recently, like you said. So there's all this lost time that could have been used to create a medication that we would have already. Isn't that the truth behind this, about all this – we wasted so much time because we demonized a substance?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this was the objection from the psychotherapists who are saying, please don't ban this. We think it's very promising. We want to study it. And you ban it, you make it very difficult to study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason this is happening, by the way, and it looks like the FDA may actually approve MDMA-assisted psychotherapy as a treatment for PTSD as soon as 2021.
Wow.
So that would be, let me think, that's like 36 years after it was banned.
Yeah.
The reason this is happening is solely because of the work that Rick Doblin has put in at the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. He was one of the people saying, please don't ban this. This is very promising.
Right.
He didn't listen to him. He turned around and he founded this organization that was dedicated to taking these prohibited substances, including MDMA, but also others, and trying to jump through all the legal hoops that are necessary to actually make them into legally available medication.
You know,
and it's amazing. I would never have thought that he would have succeeded at this, because it seems insane on its face that that you just do it in the system and go and follow whatever the bureaucrats tell you to do. Do that,
right.
And this is what he's been doing for years and years, and finally, it's paying off.
You know, what's interesting? Maybe one of the paths of progress is choosing the right subjects, the right patients, because it's really hard. Like, I've noticed this with medical marijuana and opioids, and with this study, if you choose military veterans, it is harder to deny that drug, because it's like, well, you've got to help these specific types of patients, because they've been through something. Like, for example, if you would just use patients who were suffering from mild depression or depression, they were IT workers, you know what I mean? But
right.
when you choose veterans, I think that's the effective – part of the effective strategy. Does that make any sense?
Yes. No, that's definitely true. It helps that the people that you're trying to help are veterans politically. It's very hard for both, officials in the bureaucracy and members of Congress to ignore that. That's something they tend to want to be in favor of, helping veterans, right?
Right, right.
Bipartisan sentiment.
Exactly.
And people who would otherwise not necessarily help you will be inclined to facilitate the process. And I think you mentioned it's also been true with medical marijuana, where they're starting to do research now about medical marijuana as a treatment for PTSD. And they have also emphasized the veteran angle.
Yep.
In this case, it's not as a catalyst for psychotherapy. It's more as like a day-to-day treatment that would replace other drugs that are possibly not as effective, but definitely tend to have more disturbing side effects.
So you're on the
so even something like sleeping through the night, for example. If your sleep is disrupted, it affects you your whole life, and just to resolve that one issue is a big deal. And marijuana seems to help with that. And very slowly, this is moving forward. although there's this whole hassle now. With the DEA said they were going to start authorizing new producers of marijuana for research, because currently there's only one source that is controlled by the government and is not known for its quality of variety. They said they were going to approve new sources, but Jeff Sessions seems to be stalling that whole process.
Wow. That's funny. Everybody has a good source. Everybody I know has a good source, except for what a total comparison. The only thing that could not find a good pot dealer is the government.
Right,
The pure example of bureaucracy. Do you see, because you're on the forefront of this stuff, are there other – you hear about Special K. I've heard about LSD, microdosing, and then there's the I can't think of the plant that's everybody's taking in Southern California for mind-altering effects. Do you see this other drugs that are considered illegal now being examined like this?
Yes. I mean, we're starting to see that. MDMA is probably going to be the first one to actually win FDA approval. But LSD is promising. Psilocybin, from magic mushrooms, is they're doing research with that. And I think, people like me ask, okay, marijuana is marijuana prohibition is on the ropes.
Yeah.
More and more states are legalizing it. We will eventually see the repeal of the federal ban. What's next? For people who are against drug prohibition in general, what is the next thing we can tackle? And psychedelics actually look very promising, not necessarily because they're so popular, because they're not nearly as popular as marijuana.
Right.
But because of this angle where they really do have – and LSD, this is another drug that before it was banned, people used it in therapy. And it was – Cary Grant talked about dropping acid and how it really helped him. And it seemed to help with alcoholics and so on. Right. So there's a history to this, and they have to slowly rediscover these benefits that people already knew about and, verify them in a rigorous way. And then you can actually win approval. If you had asked me, would MDMA win FDA approval one day, I would have said there's no way in hell it's going to happen. And you asked me today, will LSD win FDA approval? I think it's possible, and I think it's possible that psilocybin will as well. Both of these seem quite promising as adjuncts to psychotherapy.
You mentioned earlier that anything, and I've said this a lot of times, anything that works on pain or just makes you feel good will be abused, and that's just the human nature to kind of hijack something for party purposes. And so what we do is we react to that and we go, okay, we got to get rid of it. And it's happening, I think, with opioids. The opioid thing is I've written on it, like I said, I've quoted you on this. It's a complicated arena because you have acute pain, you have the chronic pain, and then you have the recreational user, and then you have this idea that, like, once you start taking opioids, it changes the way you perceive pain. And, like, I go back and forth. I think I think they're making it hard for patients to get opioids. But at the same time, I understand, I understand there are consequences. I think they're overreacting, but at the same time, I understand the overreaction. Where do you sit in this?
Well, the main point I try to make is that you need to disentangle the issue of opioid addiction and opioid-related deaths. And opioid-related deaths is really the main thing we ought to be concerned about right now, because that has surged very dramatically, and that's not a lie. Yeah. My tendency whenever the government talks about drugs is to assume that they're lying, because that's a good rule of thumb. It's not always true, but it's usually true. But in this case, this is really happening. It really is troubling. It really is something where you could, if you know what you're doing, you can potentially save some lives.
Right.
But that issue needs to be disentangled from the issue of pain treatment, because by and large, you are not talking about the same people. The conventional idea is, well, you go in for surgery and you're prescribed Vicodin afterward for a week or two, and you get hooked on it, and that's it, and you end up, with a heroin needle in your arm, dying in the gutter. That is what people, the scenario people tend to think of. I'm not going to say that has never happened, but it is rare.
Yeah.
And it is unusual. It is atypical. Typically, the people who are addicted to opioids, including the prescription opioids, and who end up dying as a result of drug poisoning involving opioids, are people who have longstanding problems. I mean, maybe that's not surprising.
Right.
But
yeah.
Longstanding psychological problems often have weak social support, weak, poor economic prospects. These are all, risk factors. And they use various different drugs. They don't just use prescription opioids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally not the case that this is somebody who just sort of accidentally got hooked while they were being treated for pain. If they actually get it from a doctor, which is not the rule, by the way. I mean,
right.
You look at the sources for non-medical users, most of them are not getting them through their own prescription.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they're getting it through their own prescription, it doesn't necessarily mean they were bona fide patients to begin with, because
mm-hmm.
patients can fool doctors, and some doctors are happy to be fooled. There were doctors who were making a lot of money, seeing 70 patients a day, not really seeing,
right.
giving them the slip of paper they needed to get these drugs. Right. So the fact that they had a prescription doesn't necessarily tell you they're a bona fide patient.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you look at opioid-related deaths in many states, most of these people not only didn't have a prescription at the time of their deaths, but had never been prescribed
mm-hmm.
opioids. And that's not even getting to the issue of whether it was a legitimate prescription or not. So we have to try to separate out those two issues and recognize that it is actually not very common for people treated for pain with opioids to become addicted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true certainly for short-term treatment. If you look at all the studies been done with things like, after injuries or after surgery, people get these drugs, what percentage of them show signs of addiction? It is something like 1%.
Yeah, that's exactly
possibly
right.
Possibly less than that, because that refers to a broader category than addiction. It's like any sort of sign of opioid-related problems, which may be, taking them contrary to instructions or taking them in dangerous situations, that sort of thing, not necessarily being addicted to them. But it's a very low level of addiction. The risk of overdose is even lower.
Mm-hmm.
There was one study that looked at everybody who had been prescribed opioids in the state of North Carolina in a particular year, and they looked at the deaths. And it was something like, this is, an annual rate, right?
Yeah.
0.022%
right.
of them ended up dying where an opioid was involved in that death.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a low risk. I mean, I could compare that to the risk of other prescription drugs. It's not something to dismiss entirely, obviously, but we should not be making people worry that if I accept this prescription, I'm in serious pain, and if I, use this drug that can relieve that pain, there's a good chance I'm going to be killed by it. That's
mm-hmm.
not true. And not true that there's a substantial chance that you'll become addicted to it. Even with the chronic pain patients, there's various studies that try to get a handle on that. The rates of addiction are higher, but still relatively modest. There was a review in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple years ago, and they found that it was the rates averaged something like 8% over
mm-hmm.
the long term.
Yeah.
So those risks, both the risk of addiction and the risk of a fatal overdose, are grossly exaggerated. It really does a disservice to patients
mm-hmm.
in two ways, both that you're scaring them
yep.
away from using a drug that could help them, and also that you are scaring their doctors into not prescribing the drug to begin with, even though it could help them. You might remember Jeff Sessions gave a speech a while back where he was talking about opioids. He said, we have an overprescription problem, and, you just sometimes have to take a few aspirin.
Right.
And I'm going to say grin and bear it. Somebody to that effect. Tough it out. That's what he said.
Yes.
And he gave an example of John Kelly, the former Marine mm-hmm. general, who supposedly – now, this is all through Jeff Sessions, so maybe take it with a grain of salt. But according
mm-hmm.
to Jeff Sessions, John Kelly had hand surgery. He was in very substantial pain afterward, refused as a matter of principle, apparently, to take any pain pills. And to me, fine. He can make the decision he wants. To me, it is insane
yeah.
because what is he worried about, that he's going to be addicted, that he's going to die of an overdose? It's extremely unlikely that anything like that's going to happen. So to me, on the face of it, it's irrational for him to refuse the medication that could safely and effectively relieve his pain. He wants to do that. That's his life. But he should not be, telling other people how to live their lives.
That's
if they want to use this medication.
That's the infuriating part.
Get it.
That's the infuriating part that drives me crazy is I am perfectly okay with you not liking the idea of mitigating your pain with an opioid. And that if that makes you feel like you're a better person, then you're a better person. But shut up about the other people. And you know what I mean? But I do see – even with that – and I see them – the government is now going to interfere between the patient and the doctor. And you also keep hearing about the pharmaceutical companies, which are now being – like – The pharmaceutical companies at times are being painted worse than the street dealer selling fentanyl, lethal fentanyl. But it's the evil pharmaceutical companies that have pushed the drugs on the doctors to sell more. I don't know if that's true. Maybe it's true. I don't know.
Well, there's, you know, obviously they want to sell as many of these drugs as they can, right? You have to ask, you know, what's the proper use for this product? What are the risks and benefits for any given patient? It is misleading to act as if these are predators.
Yeah.
Who are tricking doctors, mm-hmm. preying on patients, trying to get as many addicts as they can, right? Because, you know, look at it from the other angle. Somebody comes in and is faking pain in order to get a prescription. He's doing that,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
If the doctor gives him the drug, then the doctor's giving him what he wanted, right? And are they both operating under, you know, the influence of drug industry propaganda? You know, that's the idea. No, I think they're all making choices based on what they think is best. And I think it's very important to recognize that there's a moral distinction between having somebody who's in horrible, agonizing pain, who has to live with this day to day, who has this drug that if they take it, it will make their life tolerable. Not wonderful, not great, but tolerable. They can get out of bed. They might be able to hold down a job. And they're not constantly thinking about killing themselves.
Right.
And so people like that, they want to get this medication. They should be able to get it. And to deny it to them is, a terrible injustice.
Yeah.
And you're imposing this cost on them in the name of, you know, waging the war on drugs. You're imposing a cost on these innocent bystanders in the name of saving other people from themselves, because what they're doing is they're seeking these drugs. We're saying you shouldn't have them because it's not for a good reason. And if they happen to nevertheless get a prescription, they're getting what they want.
Exactly.
So in order to stop them from getting what they want, we have to prevent the pain patients from getting what they want, what they actually need in order to have tolerable lives.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it cannot be justified to do that, even if you think on balance, well, we're going to prevent a certain number of addicts, cases of addiction, and maybe there'll be some overdoses we're going to prevent, and that outweighs. No, it doesn't. You can't do that kind of calculation because morally, there's a very important distinction.
Yeah, and I got to wrap up, but it is the same. It's so weird how humans and experts and everyday people and politicians can accept all kinds of risk, whether it is with an automobile or even a firearm. I always say that all of these things are inanimate substances that are. That offer benefit and have a risk associated with them, whether it's a car, a gun, or a drug. It's all about the individual using it. Jacob, you've always been ahead of the curve on this, saying yes in defense of drug use. You wrote in 2004, you've always been kind of like the go-to person in this arena. So I urge everybody to check out Jacob's work in Reason Magazine and his. You still got a syndicated column, correct?
That's right.
Awesome. So check him out. And Jacob, thanks so much for answering my very basic questions.
Oh, thanks for asking them.
You got it. Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Take care.